The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
The back door is going to have to be protected by some kind of credential, a key. Typically, when we're talking about encryption and law enforcement access, what we're really talking about is escrowing keys. In the 1990s, when the FBI was pushing clipper chip in the first crypto wars, the idea then was that a copy of the key would be kept by some neutral third party. Not the phone company, not the government, but some kind of neutral party who would then receive orders from the government and then turn over the key. It seems like now the government is pivoting towards a model where the companies themselves keep the keys. They've said, look, we don't want the keys, we just want to be able to go to Apple, and then Apple can do this thing for us when it happens. And the problem with that backup key approach is that when you have this key, people are going to try and steal it. You know, there's this cheesy line in the movie Field of Dreams, which is, if you build it, they will come. And time again, where backdoors have been in place in systems, the bad guys have gone after them.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, November 1st, 2014. That's none other than Chris Segoyan, computer scientist, privacy and security expert, and ACLU technologist, responding to the talk that FBI Director James Comey gave at Brookings a couple weeks ago. Segoyan asked Comey a pointed question at the event about just the issue he discussed here, how you keep encryption keys safe when they're escrowed. And I asked him to join me for a more extensive response to Comey's plea to companies to preserve the ability of American law enforcement to intercept and decrypt communications. It's the Lawfare Podcast, Episode 98, Chris Segoyan Responds to Comey.
So let's just start with your thoughts on the director's speech the other day, and you know, any reactions to it that you have?
Sure. It was surprising. I mean, on one hand, we have the FBI director giving a pretty big speech on cryptography, probably the first time it's happened since Louis Freeh, I think. I mean, really, we're talking about restarting the crypto wars. On the other hand, the FBI director came to this establishment and gave this huge speech, and then when pressed by you for details said, well, you know, I'm not smart enough to really be able to explain how it works. It's a little bit odd to roll this thing out and not have any of the details ready to go.
And how do you read that? Is that, I mean, his explanation of that, I'm sure, as he said at the event, would be, I'm not here to dictate an outcome. I'm trying to start a conversation and articulate, you know, a problem that we have. I'm looking to start a conversation. Do you take that at face value, or do you think there's something sort of deeper going on there?
I mean, if this were an issue where the experts were divided, maybe then we could have a conversation. But this isn't, in fact, not an issue where the experts are divided. This is an issue where the experts are on one side. The experts say that when you add either a back door or a front door, and by the way, the difference is completely inane. When you add a backdoor or surveillance interface to a system, you weaken the security of that system. You will not find a single respected technical expert who will get up on stage and back the idea of weakening the security of a system. So you have, you know, the experts on one side, and then you have the FBI director on the other side saying, "Well, you know, my people tell me this works." The only other person I've ever seen to date to stand up for this idea is Marcus Thomas, who is the ex-head of the FBI's Operational Technology Division, now works for Subsentio, which is a purveyor of surveillance equipment, who was quoted in the Washington Post about a year and a half ago saying, "Oh yeah, as long as you just put enough engineers on it, you can make it secure." That's not really a large number of voices in support of that theory.
So I hear two basic objections to this idea, and I want to tease out which of them is yours or maybe both of them is. One is a sort of in principle objection that says, you know, the government should not be able to dictate the way architecture is built. People have the right to use, technology that they can develop. The second is a practical objection, which is to say, you can't engineer this without building in new vulnerabilities. I'm wondering which of those you subscribe to. Is the basic problem, from your point of view, a problem of ambition and principle, or is the basic problem that the Bureau's ambitions here are technologically undoable without undue cost to security?
I mean, I think both of the arguments that you raise have some merit. I'm not a lawyer. I'm a computer scientist who spent far too much time with lawyers. If you had a lawyer in this seat, I'm sure they would tell you that there's, you know, that the First Amendment protects your right to deploy whatever code you want to write. I think, you know, that is an argument that should be examined at length by the right people. I am not that person. I'm not qualified to have that fight. I'm far more focused on the latter argument simply because that's the area that I know. And that is that there are sort of two main technical concerns with the backdoor approach. The first is that every additional line of code that you add to a system creates the possibility for more bugs. And so computer security experts or computer scientists talk in terms of what's called an attack surface. The larger the attack surface, the greater the chance of the vulnerability. And so when you add an additional 5,000 lines of code for this wiretapping interface, that's 5,000 lines of code where one or more bugs could be hidden. Not hidden intentionally, but hidden unintentionally. So you have the attack surface problem. Relatedly, you also have the fact that the wiretapping interface, by its very nature, has to touch the most sensitive parts of the system. Right, so a wiretapping interface needs to have the raw user's communications going through it, which means that when you have a bug in that interface, it could lead to a catastrophic loss of security of the system as opposed to a bug in some other small, less important feature of the system. So that's sort of the bug space or the bug issue. And then the separate one you have is that the backdoor is going to have to be protected by some kind of credential, a key. Typically, when we're talking about encryption and law enforcement access, what we're really talking about is escrowing keys. In the 1990s, when the FBI was pushing clipper chip in the first crypto wars, the idea then was that a copy of the key would be kept by some neutral third party, not the phone company, not the government, but some kind of neutral party who would then receive orders from the government and then turn over the key. It seems like now the government is pivoting towards a model where the companies themselves keep the keys. They've said, look, we don't want the keys. We just want to be able to go to Apple, and then Apple can do this thing for us when it happens. And the problem with that backup key approach is that when you have this key, people are going to try and steal it. You know, there's this cheesy line in the movie Field of Dreams, which is, if you build it, they will come. And time again, where backdoors have been in place in systems, the bad guys have gone after them, where the bad guys have been the Chinese government, where the bad guys have been the Syrian Electronic Army, or the bad guys have been what is believed to be the U.S. government, which hacked into the networks of Vodafone Greece in 2004 And it's still not entirely clear what happened in the Bahamas. There was a program that was revealed by The Intercept, Glenn Greenwald's outlet, a few months back, revealing that the Bahamas had installed a lawful intercept system paid for by the U.S. government. They thought that it was going to be used on a case-by-case basis, and then the DEA and NSA worked covertly behind their backs to turn it into a nationwide interception system where all calls were being recorded. The Bahamas thought they were getting a case-by-case intercept system. What they got was wholesale bulk collection. And so, yeah, when you build this front door or a back door, someone's going to try and walk through it, and you can never really control who that person's going to be.
And your concern in this area, I assume, is not the Bureau, right? I mean, is your concern that the FBI will, in fact, not only decrypt when it has a warrant, or is your concern that – is your concern here law enforcement misconduct, or is your concern misconduct of other parties, including other governmental parties?
I mean, look, I don't think the FBI is going to be hacking into Google's law enforcement system. They can go through the front door. I mean, the legal front – whatever legal front door exists.
Whatever legal front back door.
If there is a way to walk in to the to Google's office in California with a court order of some kind, the FBI will take that. Now, their partners in the Five Eyes may try and do something else, but I think that the FBI will go through whatever legal front door exists. My problem is that, you know, I come from a background in computer security. I've heard 10 years of warnings from government officials, which have only heightened in the last five, about cybersecurity. We're told that cybersecurity is now the greatest threat this country faces, eclipsing terrorism. Not clear if Ebola now eclipses cybersecurity. You know, a week doesn't go by without a major data breach. We've had the president, the CIA director, the DNI all say that cybersecurity fears are huge. And then why are we talking about weakening the security of systems when, you know, we have a huge number of governments around the world who are trying to break into our networks? We have large organized criminal enterprises who are doing the same. It's ridiculous. We should be putting all of our resources into making our networks and our systems more secure, not less.
Now, there is, I mean, the counterargument would be, hang on a second. You don't want a degree of computer security that is going to create an ungoverned space, right? I mean, you sort of want maximum security except from lawful authority. And you want to bound that lawful authority by whatever means you have available to. But do you worry at all about what happens when you create a zone that is conceptually technologically free of surveillance, even with process?
I don't think there's any risk that we're going to get into a world where there's no surveillance.
Why not?
Because if the last 30 years are any indication, the government is only getting more data, not less. So let's take your smartphone, for example. Even if your device is storing data in encrypted form and transmitting some communications back and forth over the wire in encrypted form, you still have location data, which the laws of physics do not permit you to deny location data to the wireless carrier. If you're going to have a wireless device that can provide you with networking activity, can provide you with the ability to make and receive calls, the tower knows where you are. And there's no way around that.
Because otherwise it can't deliver the signal.
Yeah. The tower needs to know the approximate area that you're in so that it can figure out which tower to send the communications through. And then, you know, the tower knows it can sense the direction that the signals are coming from. It can sense the signal strength. With multiple towers, you can triangulate. I mean, the telephone companies in the last few years have all built self-service surveillance systems, websites where the police can log in and obtain location information, you know, whenever they'd like, as long as they've gotten the right piece of paper. They can just log in and see like a map with a dot, like Google Maps, and see people moving around. That's not going away. So that's the first thing. The second thing is there are certain kinds of services, like voice, for which latency is not a flexible thing. What I mean by that is you can have a delay for text messages, and it's okay. If your text message takes another second to reach the destination, that's okay. It still works. But if your voice call takes another second to reach the destination, then it's no longer voice. Then it's a walkie-talkie, basically. And consumers expect, you know, real-time audio. They expect low-latency audio. what that means is that the computer security community has a pretty good idea of how to hide metadata, but it generally works through systems like Tor that bounce your data through multiple servers. When you do that, you increase the latency. Audio doesn't work very well over Tor, and so, you know, yes, you can browse the web over Tor. Yes, you can send instant messages over Tor. You could do email over Tor, but voice is not going to work over a system like Tor because you want a connection that's fast, that's getting there as quickly as possible so you don't have delays, you don't have echoes. And so for the foreseeable future, until we have some kind of major development, I don't envision a world in which the government is going to lose access to metadata about calls. They may lose the contents of calls, as they probably have already done for people who use FaceTime, which is Apple's audio and video conferencing system. But the knowledge of who is calling whom at which time, they get. And given the vast amounts of information that's going over the web right now without any form of encryption, they're getting not only metadata about your online activities, but in most cases, full content. And so, you know, for the government, you having a smartphone is a net win, even if the data on that phone is encrypted. The data that goes over the wire and the carrier's ability to collect information is still a huge resource. And then that doesn't even begin to explore the fact that the FBI and other law enforcement and intelligence agencies have sophisticated capabilities to hack into endpoint devices. The FBI has a team of agents. They're called the Remote Operations Unit, ROU. They're based in Quantico. And all they do is hack into people's phones and computers. They have the ability to turn on your webcam without the light turning on. They have the ability to turn the microphone on. And so even with disk encryption, if it really matters, if we're talking about a terrorist or some kind of high-value target, the FBI can get in your device.
So why do you think, I mean, just get in the mind of Jim Comey for a minute. Why do you think now is a moment where he picks, given he knows what his capabilities are, right? Why pick this moment to reopen what must seem like a kind of a capricious war? It's a war against, in the context of Snowden, against not just against the civil libertarians and the tech community, but against the major companies, all of which are heading in this direction. He doesn't seem to have a lot of visible White House support for this. If all of this stuff gets encrypted, it's the smartphone is still a big net win for the Bureau and its partners. Why do this?
So I think there are several things that are going on. I think many of us have this tendency to think of – many of us in the tech community have this tendency to think of the FBI as bumbling fools. And let's be clear, they're not. They're very, very smart. In the last 5 or 6 years of going dark fears, whether it was Valerie Caproni or Louis Free before her, now Director Comey, the FBI has had a number of problems with companies who were not doing what they would like. Included within that are companies who are even covered by CALEA right now, wireless carriers who accidentally turn off their CALEA equipment or who redesign their networks and then don't reconnect the CALEA equipment to the new network configuration such that wiretaps don't work, companies that take far too long to respond, companies there are just problems across the board, mundane, boring problems, but problems that still stop the FBI from being able to do what they think they should be able to do. And in the 5 or 6 years that I've been watching this closely, I've never once seen the FBI call out a company by name. I've seen them go to Congress and complain that wireless carriers are not retaining records of the unique IP addresses assigned to customers. I know which carriers they are, but I didn't see that in the testimony. We've seen them call out peer-to-peer companies, but not name which particular peer-to-peer companies that is. And, I think that makes sense, right? Why provide, detailed instructions to the people that you want to wiretap, telling them, hey, if you just use this service, we're not going to be able to monitor your communications. And so with that in mind, it doesn't make any sense for the FBI director to now stand up and give this major keynote speech in which he's essentially telling the bad guys, if you just keep your data on an iPhone, we're never going to be able to get it. So I don't think he's a dummy. I think he's really smart, and I think the FBI are really smart. I don't think they're actually that concerned about the use of stored encryption. the use of encryption for stored data on iOS devices. I think what they're more concerned about is FaceTime and iMessage. So these are the encrypted text, video, and voice services that Apple has built into its platform that have been there for several years, have been enabled by default in the case of iMessage. If two people who own Apple devices communicate with each other without taking any steps, without installing any special software, without going into a configuration menu, just by turning on the phone and typing in your friend's phone number, suddenly your messages are now encrypted end-to-end with keys that Apple doesn't have. I mean, in addition to the law enforcement stuff, the carriers are not terribly happy because text messaging is a huge source of revenue for them, and it's very easy revenue. So Apple rolled that out. They've rolled out FaceTime and then FaceTime audio. But to date, the company has never really advertised the service as secure. You use FaceTime because you want to talk to your kids when you're traveling. You know, iMessage, you don't even know it's there. It's just a slightly different color in the interface. But for those products, they are making life more difficult for law enforcement. You know, it makes sense. You go from a system that's entirely plain text to one that's encrypted end-to-end with keys that the company doesn't have. You know, wiretaps aren't going to be as useful as they were before. And, you know, I think that the recent kerfuffle is a chance for the FBI to put pressure on Apple, to put pressure on Google, to put pressure more broadly on Silicon Valley without revealing that which particular things they're worried about. I think this is a case of misdirection. This is a way of getting Apple to the negotiating table. This is a way of lighting a fire on Capitol Hill and getting some pro-law enforcement voices to start putting pressure on companies. I don't think that the FBI expects that there's going to be Kalia 2 passed next year. But I do think they think that they can put some pressure on the tech companies. And even if they cannot convince Apple to back down, there are a number of other companies who have products that are in late development right now. And my guess is the FBI thinks that if they create enough noise, maybe they can put the brakes on the deployment of those technologies.
And is there any compromise possible here? I mean, is this a binary thing that either you're doing end-to-end encryption or you're not? Or is there some... You know, is there some formula, if you take the sort of highest altitude proposition that law enforcement with an appropriate warrant should be able to find out what person X is saying to person Y, is there any conceivable way to engineer that capability without creating a possibly catastrophic security breach?
I mean, if we were talking solely about, you know, a form of encryption that the NSA could break, that the FBI and local law enforcement could not, then that's the encryption we already have right now. I mean, there are several algorithms that are in widespread use on your computer and your web browser that computer scientists think are not that safe, that we think that, you know, with $1 million and a week of time that the NSA could break. But that doesn't trickle down to law enforcement. Really what you're asking is there a way of building a system that keeps the Chinese government out, that keeps sophisticated Russian organized crime out, but that allows local law enforcement in? And the answer is no.
But I assume there are also algorithms that would be sufficiently powerful or are sufficiently powerful that it would require an enormous investment even of NSA's time to break. Or is that not right? And you should assume that if NSA really wants to listen to you, there's nothing you can do about it.
I mean, if NSA really, really wants to listen to you, they're probably not going to break the encryption. They're probably going to bypass the encryption. They'll hack into your device. They will, you know, they or the CIA will sneak into your hotel room and plant a bug. Adi Shamir, who is one of the sort of grandfathers of modern cryptography, the S in RSA, likes to say that cryptography is typically bypassed, not broken. Right. Now, to be clear, you know, the NSA is the largest employer of mathematicians in the United States. They're doing something. You know, what they're doing hasn't shown up in any of the Snowden stories, and I think that likely just reflects the fact that Snowden didn't have access to those documents. They are definitely focused on, you know, encryption algorithms, and you know, the fact is that in 1943, the Germans had a special machine, the Enigma machine, that was used by the German government and just the German government. And so the U.S. government could find flaws in the Enigma machine, and that, you know, that, well, it was the U.S., the Poles, and the Brits together, and that really sort of helped to turn the tide in the war. In 2014, you know, Enigma-type machines are really not very common. I mean, there are some special encryption algorithms that the U.S. government uses. So, for example, the Suite A algorithms that NSA produces. But most governments around the world use off-the-shelf cryptography in the same way that, you know, the president's using an iPad for his presidential daily briefing, right? They don't want to build special devices for governments anymore. And so what that means then is that, you know, banks and law firms and doctor's offices are all using the same encryption as the German government or the Saudi government or the Finnish government. And what that, of course, then means is that the NSA's mathematicians are then focused on the cryptographic algorithms that are not just protecting the secrets of our adversaries, the secrets of governments that have information that we might want, but they're also protecting the secrets of Americans, of our banks, of our medical records. You know, there are some really interesting questions that need to be asked, which is, you know, if the NSA's mathematicians discover a flaw in the encryption algorithms that we are all depending on, will they tell us?
Right. So they have a conflict of interest here, a profound one, because the U.S. government has a conflict of interest in general, right? That is to say, it wants data to be perfectly secure from everybody except itself, and ideally perfectly insecure from itself. What is the right way to resolve that conceptual? I mean, if you're a government that has to, A, supervise a banking system that you want to be secure, and B, spy on the North Koreans and Al-Qaeda, you have an interest both in computer security and computer insecurity. What's the right, you know, as a technologist and a computer scientist, what is the right way to think about that problem?
So I've been in Washington, D.C. since 2009. I spent a year in the government at the Federal Trade Commission. And so, you know, I understand that there's not one person pulling the strings behind the curtain in D.C.
Yeah, the unitary executive is a myth.
Right. So it's not that the government has a conflict of interest. In fact, it's that there are different agencies within the government that have completely different missions. And in some cases, you have different departments in the same agency that have competing missions. So, for example, you know, my guess is that the folks at IAD, the Information Assurance Directorate at NSA, were laughing when Comey gave his speech last week. These are the people who are tasked with protecting government systems. These are the guys who built the customized iPad for the president. They don't want back doors in the president's iPad or a front door. They don't want any door, right? They ripped out the Wi-Fi chip before they would give it to the president. The folks who are focused on defense want things to be as secure as possible. You know, I think there are different parts of the government and they have different missions. I think for companies, it's a nightmare to deal with. You have the Federal Trade Commission, you have state attorneys general who are investigating, punishing, and fining companies that have poor security. You have state legislatures around the country passing laws mandating the use of encryption. You have the FBI issuing public documents recommending the use of encryption. Sean Henry, who's now at CrowdStrike, in one of his last speeches at the FBI, told companies that one of the most important things they could do to protect themselves against data breaches was encrypt. Right? You have FBI officials telling people to encrypt. You go to the NSA's website, and there are how-to documents for how to turn on encryption and how to lock it down, how to make a device as secure as possible. You know, there's a huge machine within the government that is focused on making things more secure, on pressuring the private sector to make things more secure. You have the Commerce Department, which is entrusted with, you know, protecting the U.S. economy. They want systems to be more secure because they know that U.S. companies cannot sell insecure products abroad. You have the White House, which seems to be paralyzed right now, but, you know, the new deputy CTO of the White House, Alex McGillivray, who came from Twitter, you know, he was quoted in the New York Times 2 years ago saying that no one wants a pencil that will rat them out. So that seems to make it clear at least what OSTP thinks about backdoors. And then you have law enforcement. You have the FBI. You have DEA. You have other folks in the law enforcement community. And the fact is that they have a really bad track record when it comes to balancing the equities. So a great example of this is the Stingray, which has been on the front page of newspapers around the country for the last few months. for 20 years, law enforcement agencies in this country, law enforcement and intelligence agencies, have known that our telephone system, our wireless telephone system, was vulnerable. That with the right kind of equipment, you could just sit in your house or in a car and listen to the phone calls of people nearby. They knew this. They bought the equipment. They petitioned the FCC to create an exemption to the broad prohibition against interception equipment to make sure that they could have this stuff. And then they used it. They put it into use. They kept this secret from the public and largely from the courts. And in the last 20 years, initially, it was just Western companies who were making this stuff. And in the last 20 years, you now have companies in China, in Israel, in Russia, in Pakistan, companies in countries all over the world who are selling this stuff. Every intelligence service in the world now has this equipment. They're called IMSI catchers or stingrays. I mean, these are the devices that are on the roofs of embassies. These are the devices that are, you know, in the trunk of one of the cars that accompanies the president. They're used for force protection, for IED protection, but they're also now used by every state and local law enforcement agency in the country. And so here you have a classic example, right? On one hand, you have a technology demonstrating that our telephone system is vulnerable. We have solid evidence that foreign governments and now criminals are using this technology. But the law enforcement community in this country is united in silence. They don't want anyone to know about the vulnerabilities that this equipment exploits. They have colluded with the FCC to keep the public entirely in the dark about the vulnerabilities and about the use of this technology by law enforcement. But in doing so, they're leaving us vulnerable to foreign governments and to hackers, too, or to criminals. You know, the FBI doesn't have a cybersecurity mission. They have a mission to go out and investigate crimes and to catch the bad guys. And given the choice between reporting a vulnerability and exploiting it, they're always going to exploit. And today, 20 years after the Stingray was put into production, the FBI still won't tell anyone about it. Graduate students have written PhD dissertations about this technology, and the FBI continues to insist that it's a secret. They won't even acknowledge which technology they use.
But are you... I mean, I'm trying to push you to see whether you'll go to the other extreme. Is your view that a vulnerability should always be reported and always be patched, as in it in the basic conflict that the government has between wanting both to be able to exploit and to spy, to surveil in the law enforcement context, and the desire to have secure systems in general, that we should always err, that defense should always win?
I mean, are we asking about the world that I want to live in? Or a fantasy world? Because if we're talking about fantasy, then I want a pony as well. But
No. I'm asking for your vision of the public good. I'm saying if you're president of the United States and you have these different agencies, which I quite rightly agree, it's both different agencies and different components of the same agencies that have very different senses of what the equities are and how to balance them. But ultimately, as you described earlier, the technology is binary. You either build it to be as secure as possible or you build it to have vulnerabilities. What's the right answer for the U.S. federal government?
Well, the answer right now is that Michael Daniels, the cyber czar, who has no background in cyber, posted a blog post this summer after Heartbleed in which he said that the default policy of the U.S. government, the de facto policy of the U.S. government, was to notify companies about vulnerabilities unless there was a law enforcement or national security use for the information. This exception, of course, swallows the entire rule. You know, I think what many
people... We'll always report except when we won't.
Right, but I think what many people don't understand is that, you know, when you get word that Vladimir Putin just bought a new iPhone, that's not the time that you then start looking for iOS vulnerabilities. You don't start developing the weapon when you get, you know, word of where bin Laden is. You have to have the weapon ready to go, right? Which means that you can't really balance the equities appropriately if you don't even know how they're going to be used. And so what really happens is that law enforcement and the intelligence community want to have broad capabilities without knowing ahead of time how they're going to be used. They need to have a vulnerability for iOS, for Windows, for macOS, for Safari, for Firefox, or for Chrome in their pocket, just in case. And they need to have several of them because they might get found. They might get used. You know, another researcher independently discovers them. I'm not so unrealistic to expect that the NSA is going to get out of the exploitation business. There's a huge team, tailored access operations, at the fort that just, you know, discovers, weaponizes, and then exploits vulnerabilities. There's a huge number of defense contractors, including, you know, Mantech and Raytheon and Harris, who are selling vulnerabilities, whether, you know, the information about the vulnerability or weaponized exploit. They're selling them to the intelligence community, to NSA, to the CIA, to JSOC. All of those agencies have their own independent weaponized exploitation programs. You know, I'm not so naive to think that they're going to get out of the business in the same way that I don't think that JSOC or CIA are going to get out of the drone business. I'd like them to, but it's not going to happen. But let's talk about law enforcement. I think that 0 days are too dangerous for the FBI. I think that law enforcement should not have gotten into the hacking business without telling Congress first. I mean, let's remember for a moment, there have been zero congressional hearings about the use of hacking by law enforcement. There's a dedicated team at the FBI. All they do is deliver malware to people's computers, and they've never once had an open hearing before Congress, one, telling Congress what's taking place, and two, seeking the authority to do so. The first time this has even come up is in an obscure committee in the Administrative Office of the Courts. They're having a hearing next month in Washington, D.C., and because DOJ is seeking the authority to hack into computers in unknown locations or computers that are abroad, outside of the area of the judge, the area of jurisdiction of the judge who's issuing the search warrant. This is not something that has taken place with appropriate judicial oversight, with appropriate legislative oversight, and that would it's a problem even if they're using just vulnerabilities that are known and that the bad guys haven't patched. But when we're talking about the FBI either buying 0 days, which they do, or finding 0 days, which they're probably not doing, that needs to be under strict control. I mean, I don't think it should be happening at all. I think it's far too dangerous. But if it's going to happen, it needs to happen under some kind of system of democratic oversight. And all they've done to date is evade oversight.
So you work for the ACLU. You've been in the computer security and civil liberties business for a long time. What do you do to protect yourself? You've been sometimes critical of Lawfare for our technical infrastructure and for the fact that we don't use HTTPS. What do you do? I mean, what if somebody wants to protect themselves and be, you know, a reasonably safe citizen but not go nuts? What should they be doing?
I mean, I think the average citizen isn't living in the same threat environment that I am or that you are, realistically, Ben. You know, I think for the average American, the biggest threat they're going to face is online crime. You know, someone hacking into their computer, not law enforcement, but a criminal of some kind, malware. You know, and in that case, they've been woefully ignored and ignored by the government. I mean, for all of the power struggle that has taken place in Washington over cyber, you know, everyone wants the money and the power that goes along with cyber, but no one wants the actual responsibility for protecting consumers' computers. Right? For the average consumer, they are their own CIO and they are their own CTO, and they're doing a really bad job of it. And that's okay because, you know, I'm a bad doctor and I'm a bad mechanic, and as a new homeowner, I'm definitely a bad construction manager. You know, regular Americans don't have the time to become computer experts, and the government hasn't really done a very good job of protecting them. And largely, that, I think that boils down to, you know, lack of regulation. The Federal Trade Commission doesn't really have the authority to punish companies proactively. They can only go in and clean up the mess when things get really bad. You know, for the average person, I would tell them, you know, to make sure to keep their computers patched, to make sure they're running updated software, to use a password manager instead of using the same password on every website. I mean, there are sort of basic forms of hygiene. You know, for those of us who live in a different sort of threat environment, for those of us who work in national security, for lawyers, for journalists who are worried about surveillance, then, you know, you need to start taking matters into your own hands. So that means encrypting your voice communications, encrypting your text communications. It means encrypting your hard drive. You definitely should be encrypting your hard drive. If for no other reason that, you know, your laptop is stolen or you leave it in a taxi, you don't want someone to get your tax documents. You know, and I work under circumstances that mean that I have to focus on security a bit more than the average person. And my boss is Snowden's lawyer. my attorneys are frequently, the attorneys I work with are frequently going down to Gitmo and other places where the government has engaged in what could charitably be described as surveillance shenanigans. I push the use of voice encryption within the ACLU, and you know, it's been working. People have been upping their game. The number of reporters that I work with who have now adopted both email encryption, text message encryption, and voice encryption has just gone through the roof. And let me be clear, you know, the reason why I've been pressuring you to move to HTTPS, the reason why I pressured the people at ACLU to move it, the reason why I've been harassing the Washington Post and the New York Times. Many people think that the encryption or what the form of encryption is known as HTTPS, the lock icon on your browser, many people think, oh, this is just for sensitive information, for credit cards.
Yeah, I think of it as a protection for commerce. I've been sort of bewildered by your insistence that we need it. So walk me through it. Why am I wrong?
In the 90s, when SSL, which was the predecessor technology, was created, it was created by Netscape so that people would feel comfortable to transmit credit card numbers over the internet. So it was for commerce. So let me give you an example. You're visiting the website of a major DC law firm, a huge practice, one of these big law firms. They have partners who do many different things. The fact that you are visiting the white-collar crime page on that site is interesting compared to looking up a partner who specializes in divorce or tax evasion or criminal defense, right? The pages on the site that you're visiting can reveal more information than just the fact that you're visiting, you know, a law firm in general. If you're visiting the website of Planned Parenthood, Planned Parenthood has, you know, STD tests and, you know, sort of well woman services and abortions. The fact that you're visiting the webpage that provides information about abortions is far more sensitive than the fact that you're just visiting the Planned Parenthood site overall. You know, let's say you're visiting the website of Senator Grassley, who's really big on waste, fraud, and abuse. He has a form that you can click on that lets you report fraud, right? The fact that I'm visiting the senator's website is interesting. The fact that I'm visiting the page on the site that lets me report waste, fraud, or abuse is very, very interesting.
So imagine for a moment that Lawfare had HTTPS. What then exactly is encrypted, and how is it protected from whom?
So HTTPS, if it were used by Lawfare, would protect from anyone watching the network, which could be the internet service provider, Comcast or Verizon. It would be your employer, your university, anyone watching the Wi-Fi network if you're browsing the web at Starbucks. It would protect from those entities the information about which particular pages on the Lawfare site you're visiting. It wouldn't protect the fact that someone is visiting Lawfare, but you know, there are many different people who blog at Lawfare, and there are many different kinds of content. So I only read certain articles on Lawfare. I know that there are people who just read the articles about drones, and there are people who just read the articles about NSA surveillance, and people who just read things about torture. You know, by the same token, you know, I read the Volok conspiracy, but I only actually read Oren Kerr's stuff because I think that Stuart Baker is an insufferable troll. So the fact that I'm only visiting Oren Kerr's articles on the Washington Post website, you know, that's something that would only be protected if I were using HTTPS. And, you know, the news that people read, the news articles that people read really reveals a lot about their personalities. It's for that reason that ad networks are so desperate to learn that information. If you're looking at sports information, that can reveal something. You know, it can reveal what team you're interested in. If you're looking at articles about LGBT rights all the time, that may reveal something. And, you know, I think, again, I'm not a lawyer, but at the core of the First Amendment isn't just the right to speak, but also the right to read. And if someone is looking over your shoulder when you're reading and taking notes, well, you know, you may decide to stop clicking on links to articles that are sensitive or that you don't want others to know about.
Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with, you guessed it, the Brookings Institution. Thanks this week to the folks in the Brookings studio for hosting Segoyan and me. Our music, as ever, is performed by Ms. Sophia Yan, who always says,
I mean, let's remember for a moment, there have been zero congressional hearings about the use of hacking by law enforcement.
You need to help us spread the word about the Lawfare Podcast. rate it, share it, review it, browbeat your friends into subscribing. Thanks for listening.